On Independence Day, July 4th, 1917, an editorial appeared in the New York Times entitled, "Jails Are Waiting for Them." It read in part, quote, "Freedom of speech is a fine thing, well worth fighting for and even dying for in case of need, but sensible people do not make the mistake of believing that speech can be literally free in any civilized country. Inevitably, there must be restrictions on speech, as on the exercise of religion, even in lands with constitutions guaranteeing both, for between liberty and license, there is a distinction." It went on to decry a, quote, "little group of malcontents who were arguing that freedom of speech should mean they were free to criticize the government and the ongoing First World War." The New York Times assured its readers that these troublesome folk, who were calling themselves the National Civil Liberties Bureau, are, quote, "an unimportant and minute minority, noisy out of all proportion to their numbers and gaining attention just as crimes and accidents do, merely because they are abnormal and therefore news." That troublesome group of malcontents that the Times had such harsh words for, the National Civil Liberties Bureau, you might have guessed, became the American Civil Liberties Union, which I joined with my birthday money when I turned 12 years old, and where I work now. Now, we take for granted, 117 years later, that indeed freedom of speech does mean that people are free to quote the New York Times again, antagonize the settled policies of the government without jails waiting for them. But it was barely more than a century ago, during the lifetimes of our grandparents, even some of our parents, that federal law in this country made it an offense carrying up to 20 years in prison to use disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive language about the United States, its government, its flag, or its military. In its first decade or so of existence, the ACLU's primary work was to establish in the courts and in public opinion the understanding of freedom of speech that we all, across the political spectrum, share today. That we are indeed free to criticize the government, that in that regard, at least, liberty does indeed entail license. Maybe for obvious reasons, I've been thinking about this history this week, thinking about my organization's history, about the way my forebears in this work took such an unpopular stand and faced opposition from the federal government and from public opinion, even faced jail. I've been thinking about how they were right, about how they ultimately achieved their goals, and also about how the work has not ended or even gotten a lot easier. In the very same newspaper that once said the organization's founders belonged in jail for daring to criticize the government, the National ACLU took out a full-page ad this week with an open letter to President-elect Trump that read in part, "At the ACLU, we play the long game. We've been around for 105 years and have seen 19 presidents come and go. That's why any attempt to roll back the nation's civil liberties on our watch will be hard fought and met with the full power of our resistance." And I was thinking about this history. I was thinking about the next chapter of that story that we find ourselves in. And I was doing all of that while I was reading the gospel text for today. Here in Mark's gospel, Jesus gives us a portrait of the powerful alongside a portrait of someone the powerful overlook. He begins with the critique of the scribes, the legal experts, leaders who love honor and enjoy influence. They present themselves as righteous, yet Jesus says they devour widows' houses, even as they stand in positions of spiritual authority. Now, his critique of these leaders might feel familiar today as well, 2,000 years later, as we still see leaders who hide behind facades of piety and power while doing harm, especially to the vulnerable. Yet, in the same passage, Jesus shifts our gaze to a poor widow, giving two small coins at the temple. The translation that I read for said it was worth barely more than a penny. One scholarly resource that I read said that it was, we often think in the Bible about the the unit of coin, a denarius, which is about a day's wage for a day's work, right? It's enough to buy food for a day. What she gave was worth 1/128th of a day's wage. She had so little. She didn't even have a full day, didn't even have food to feed herself for a day. And Jesus tells us that she embodies the values that his ministry upholds, not in the grandeur of her gift, but in her humble, unnoticed sacrifice. Her act raises questions for us today. In a time when taking a stand for the dignity of others can feel like swimming against the tide, what does it mean to give your whole life for people who may not even notice what you've done? What does it mean to dedicate yourself to a vision of justice and compassion that remains invisible to the powerful? The widow gave all she had to live on. Her gift went unnoticed by most around her, but Jesus sees and honors it as the model of true faithfulness. It was an act of generosity that might be small and humble and overlooked in the eyes of so many, but it stands for us as a lesson of persistent, determined faithfulness to a vision of what can be. In my mind, I imagine her kind of quietly giving those coins, knowing that her act wouldn't change the brokenness in her society overnight, but choosing to contribute what she had to a communal space she hoped could serve a purpose greater than its flaws. The treasury in the temple didn't exist just to perpetuate the temple's ministry. It was part of the economy of the time. People gave what they had, and the treasury was part of the social support network of the society. What was given was then given back out into the community. But it didn't work always very well. Jesus says they're devouring widows' houses. And yet one of those very same widows comes to the treasury and gives all that she has. When I was a freshman in college, my friend Stephanie called me one day and said, "I just found out that Fannie Lou Hamer is buried just a few hours' drive from here. Do you want to drive out and visit her grave this weekend?" And I said yes, because that's the kind of thing you say yes to when you're a freshman in college. And then I got on my laptop and looked up who Fannie Lou Hamer was, because I had never heard of her. And I found out that Fannie Lou Hamer was a very cool person. She was a black woman from Mississippi and a trailblazing voting rights activist during the modern civil rights movement. You may have heard her famous words that she was sick and tired of being sick and tired. Hamer was the daughter of sharecroppers, and she knew the daily struggles of poverty and racism firsthand. And in her work demanding fair treatment for black voters, she faced beatings, arrests, even threats of death. She lived in Mississippi, and the Mississippi Democratic Party delegation to the 1964 Democratic National Convention was all white because the Mississippi Democratic Party engaged in systematic exclusion of black people from their political process. And so Fannie Lou Hamer and a multiracial group of activists in Mississippi formed an alternative party. They called it the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And they sent an integrated delegation to Atlantic City, seeking to be seated as the official delegation from Mississippi. And although some in the DNC leadership sought to seat Hamer and her fellow MFDP delegates, or at least to split the Mississippi seats between the integrated delegation and the all-white delegation, then-President Lyndon Johnson feared losing Southern votes, and so he maneuvered behind the scenes to offer a compromise to allow only two of the MFDP delegates to be seated. There were 68 of them in total. The MFDP refused the inadequate compromise. And then, when the all-white official Mississippi delegation walked out of the convention because of LBJ's support for civil rights, MFDP activists attempted to take their seats. Convention organizers instead physically removed the seats of the delegates who'd walked out. And so the MFDP sang freedom songs on the convention floor. They were never seated as official delegates at that convention, but their activism at the 1964 Democratic Convention, and particularly Fannie Lou Hamer's testimony, are widely credited with having built support for the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Activists from Mississippi proposed Fannie Lou Hamer as a speaker at the convention, and LBJ refused, saying he didn't want an illiterate woman speaking at the convention. Today, the chairperson of the Mississippi Democratic Party is Black, a far cry from the all-white party that Fannie Lou Hamer worked to change. This is a posture of love and resistance that invites us to stay engaged in a long work of building a world more reflective of God's vision for justice, mercy, compassion, and peace. And it brings to us another question that her story raises for me, and our gospel story raises for me. What does it mean to care deeply about an institution, not for what it is, but for what it could be? As we think about the work that we're called to advocate for those who are oppressed and marginalized in our society, to care for those who need God's care and our own, to lift our voices for justice, especially in times when the political climate might be disheartening or even hostile, the widow's commitment speaks volumes. She gives what she has, not because the temple is perfect, but because she hopes her small offering can contribute to something larger. In so many areas of our lives, certainly in our political lives, but not only in our political lives, we too hold hopes for institutions that often disappoint us. And yet we invest ourselves, not out of blind loyalty, but in a belief that in what they could be if they truly reflected God's love and justice. We bring food to the hungry, shelter to the vulnerable, compassion to the suffering, believing that God's vision for our community includes these acts, even when we engage in them imperfectly. The widow's faith in what God is doing in her community is a model of persistence and hope, a reminder to keep contributing what we can, even when the structures around us fall short of our vision for them. And then what does it mean to persevere in that work, to keep giving what we can, even when it feels small and unrecognized? The problems we face in our society are vast. The problems we face in our community are vast. It can be intimidating to think, what can I do to end hunger? What can I do to change the patterns of police violence in New Mexico? What can I do to avoid catastrophic climate change? Those are very real questions, and Jesus, I think, speaks to them in this passage. The widow gives her last two coins, knowing that they're not going to change the world on their own. One 128th of a day's income is not enough to change everything. And in the same way, our work for justice and compassion, our advocacy, our service, our prayers, may feel like drops in a vast ocean of need. But we are invited to keep contributing our part, because as the widow's story shows us, what may seem small or unnoticed to the world is seen and honored by God. It's a reminder to stay faithful, to invest in the long game of justice, to believe that as we each give what we can in service to one another, God is working through these small acts to weave a greater tapestry of healing and justice. Jesus saw the widow's gift as an expression of faith and love, not for what it could do on its own, but for what it represented. In the same way, we are called to resist despair and disillusionment, to stay engaged in the work to which we are called, to give what we have for the good of others, even when it feels small. Like the founders of the National Civil Liberties Bureau, like Fannie Lou Hamer, like so many people whose persistent, faithful work has reshaped history, we are reminded that our faithfulness matters. And so as we face a new chapter in history, may we continue as a community to be troublesome folk, to give our lives, our voices, and our hopes for a vision of justice, mercy, and compassion that reflects God's heart for all people. Like the widow, let us not measure our worth or our impact by the world's standards, but by God's love, which sees, honors, and multiplies even our smallest acts of faith. Amen.